can I be willing to guarantee, even in the entire span of history, that the world will always decide that what is right, and what is wrong is wrong? Now, don't get me wrong here, because it doesn't mean that this suggests or proves that the atheist is wrong. You could quite simply say, fine, if Adolf Hitler won, and by the way, you have to realize, in 1940, Adolf Hitler controlled all of Western Europe, a big chunk of Eastern Europe. He was rolling deep into Russia. America was a year and a half away from even being involved in the war, let alone getting anywhere. England had been defeated at Dunkirk. My mother is English. She watched the Battle of Britain in the air from a ditch. They were convinced that the next stage was the Nazi invasion of England, because he took Czechoslovakia and France and everything else. So Hitler could very easily have won. As a matter of fact, if you look at history, this is another discussion, it makes no sense that Hitler didn't win. The things that the Nazis did to determine that they lost make absolutely no sense. The fact that they were using all of their rail lines and all of their trains to deport Jews to Poland when they had no supply lines to the front is amazing. But if Hitler had won, then it stands to reason that the world would have become Nazi and that all of us would have either disappeared or become indoctrinated in the Hitler Youth, and the whole world, or the majority of it, would have decided that what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong. I'll give you another example. Let's say that we define right as being something that I don't do because I don't want somebody to do it to me. So let me give you an extreme example. And I recognize this is an extreme example. It's a ridiculous example. But it's a way to illustrate a point. And I don't say, I have to keep reminding you of this. I'm not saying that this thought process should be your thought process at all. I'm trying to explain to you my thought process so that I can get to where I got to, so that then I can discuss it with you, okay? That's why we call this introduction, right? But they did an unbelievable study. You know, at a certain time in my life, I was in the Army. I was in the Army for 4.5 years. And I have a very close friend who has been missing in action since 1982, Zach Bamel. He's one of the Israeli MIAs. Got very close to his family. And I became tremendously preoccupied by this when I was in the Army. First of all, one of the reasons that he was captured was because his sergeant didn't really know how to navigate properly. And they were, it's a long story, but they ended up out in the field. They had to abandon their tank. They were surrounded by the Syrians. They were in the middle of a battle. But they could have gotten away. He didn't know exactly which way to go. It was the middle of the day. There was artillery. There was smoke. There was fire. It's a little easier to navigate at night by the stars. So they decided to split up into two pairs. And this one will go this way, and that one will go that way. And they'd hope someone would get back and tell. And it's quite clear, because the sergeant eventually was released in a prisoner exchange 2 years later, that he had no idea what he was doing in navigation during the day. It's very hard to navigate during the day. The sun changes its position. Moss, which grows towards the south, isn't always there. So I became fanatic about this. First of all, I had all my men on their tanks. They had a pack, a knapsack, a tabao, with gear in it that they would need for survival, right? And God forbid, if any tank ever got stuck out in the field, they could grab their knapsack and they would have what they need. I, in navigation, in officer's course, went, you know, nuts with this stuff. And I guess part of this is psychological. And I made sure my guys knew how to navigate and all this stuff. And part of this was, one of my most difficult questions, which I never got an answer to, was what do I do if I'm captured? Do I tell them I'm an American citizen? And I was like a little troubled by this. I didn't know what the best way to go was. Should I tell them I'm an American citizen? Should I not? So I started reading up on all these things. And while I was into this, I got into interrogation techniques. You know, would it help me one day? And I was also, you know, I mean, I was 20 years old, and, you know, I was fascinated by this stuff. But would it help me one day if, God forbid, I was ever caught and being interrogated? Because what they do is, they have a day in the Israeli army, it's called Yom Shevi, and they go through all the methods of interrogation and all the things, so that if you're prepared for it a little bit, at least you'll know what you're doing, especially in officer's course. And the Syrians, for example, send local interrogators to interrogate an Israeli soldier, but if it's an officer, then there's special interrogators that come from Damascus. So you learn that one of the first things you do, God forbid, if you are in enemy territories, you take off your epaulettes. You don't want them to know you're an officer. You don't have to tell them you're an officer. That name, rank, and serial number, it's not true. You just have to tell them your name and your serial number, right? And you can lie about your rank, you know? If I get up to heaven, I figured, and God said, told them you were a sergeant, huh? You know, so I figured, you know. So while I was reading this, I came across an amazing study. It was a study from the, I think it was post-Vietnam War, on POWs who had returned from just terrible experiences. And some of these POWs, these prisoners of war, had undergone just the most intensive periods of pain and suffering that we can only begin to imagine. All alone, by the way, which in certain ways is much more difficult, you know, than some of the things that, you know, our people have suffered in groups. And I remember reading one account of a guy who was kept in a water cage on the Mekong Delta. What they used to do was they would lower a prisoner into the river in a bamboo cage. And you know, you ever wash the dishes and your skin starts to like sort of peel and get soft? Well, this guy was kept in this cage for a year. So imagine what happens to your skin if you're in water for a year. There were water rats in there, and they started, you know, biting him and eating him and infections. And when the tide would rise, he had to keep his hands locked into the bamboo. The question that this study dealt with was, how did this person deal with this? And every now and then they would come to take him to interrogations, all sorts of terrible electrocution therapy and whatever else it is. And they found that there were always two results. There were two possibilities a person could choose. He could either go completely mad and escape his reality, right? Which is a form of death, maybe. Or, this is another form of madness, he would become a sadomasochist. These prisoners would learn to love the pain. Because if you're living in a cell, and somebody's walking down, every time he walks down the hallway, you know that pain is coming. The anticipation of pain was very often more difficult than the pain itself. And sometimes what they would do is they would just walk down the hall at an odd hour just to terrify these prisoners, hear them shaking in their cages. So they would learn to love the pain. And then you could deal with these footsteps. Now you can imagine a guy comes back from the war after 6 or 7 years of this, and he's a sadomasochist. I mean, that's got to play havoc on a healthy marriage. And these men had just tremendous difficulties adapting. Many of them weren't able to. So now you run into a guy like this, right? And you're on the subway. And I recognize this is a completely extreme example. And you run into this guy in a subway, and he walks over, he slaps you in the face. And you say to him, "Don't do that to me, that's wrong, because you wouldn't want me to do that to you." And he says, "Sure I would." So how do I define wrong? How do I know that what makes something wrong is simply my perception? So I grant you, that's a ridiculous example, but you understand my point. I want to tell you the root of my point. By definition, you know, Bertrand Russell once said, to believe that what's wrong with cruelty, now he was a self-proclaimed atheist, I don't know if he changed later in his life, but to believe that what's wrong with cruelty is simply that I don't like it, is to believe the absurd. In other words, he recognized the problem. I never figured out, to be honest, how he dealt with it. I know how he says he dealt with it. And that's probably my failing, because there are brilliant people who are atheists, so there must be a logical way, but I was never able to find it. So, by definition, I can do one of two things. I can either accept that ethics are subjective, that whatever we decide makes sense. But if I want an objective ethic, if I want something just to be wrong, then as an atheist, I'm going to have a problem. If my children are walking through the park and they want to play soccer, and there's no soccer ball, but they find a kitten, so they want to play soccer with the kitten, how do I tell them they're wrong? I'm giving you an extreme example which makes no sense. As an example, I don't think that a Vietnam sadomasochist wants to be slapped. Okay, I don't think that's the definition of sadomasochism. God forbid. I don't think that anybody should go over and find a Vietnam man and slap him. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that if such a person would exist, okay, I wanted you to understand where that thought process. In other words, if my only definition of right or wrong is that something is wrong because I don't want it done to me, then by definition, if I want something done to me, I mean, I'll give you an example. If there's an ultra-Orthodox Jew, however we define it, and he lives in Mea Shearim, and we're using now 2 or 3 stereotypes, and he throws a rock at a car driving on Shabbos, he may very well want you to throw a rock at him if he's driving on Shabbos, because he thinks that you're waking him up to reality. Yeah. That doesn't... And if that's what makes it right, then he's right!
Well, that's just that is
a very complex thing. 100%. So let me show you now where I'm going with this, okay? All right, I hear you. Let me show you where I'm going with this.
I'm back to the kid.
Okay. No. You gotta trust me. Okay. Here's my problem. And I want to tell you something. I don't think there's an answer to this problem. I'm sharing with you my perception. And by the way, if some of you are finding this like difficult, like that's good. Because I think that these struggles, you know, for me, I would read this stuff at night, and I'd go to school in the day, and I'd be listening to some social history teacher talking about the Nat Turner Rebellion, whatever, and I'd be like just exploding with all this and trying to figure this out. And I sometimes would cut school for a day, you know? And I remember my mom, she once like found out that I'd cut school, whatever. She wanted to know what I did all day. How do you tell your mom that you were reading Kant and Kierkegaard? And I wasn't some Fruit Loop, you know, geek, you know, not that I think that that's what it was, but I knew that if my friends knew that I cut school to read Kant and Kierkegaard, you know, that's what they think. So, you know, this is a problem, but I was just really struggling with this. And I think it's a good struggle. And I reached a conclusion, which was an 18-year-old conclusion. It's a little more difficult for me now, but okay. Which was that you can't expect the atheist to resolve this problem. the existential truth seems to be, but again, this is just my perception, is that if there is no God, then the only truth I can come to has to be a subjective truth. In other words, if I want to have something objectively right or objectively wrong, if I want something to be wrong just because it's wrong, then I can't base that wrong on humanity. I'll give you an example. You take, for example, the right to bear arms in the American Constitution. I want you to know the American Constitution is a magnificent work that a group of human beings could sit down and come up with. This, it's incredible. And we, by the way, this is a separate issue, as the Jewish people owe such a tremendous debt of gratitude to America for what they've done for the Jewish people. And even though I've chosen to live in Israel and I have my problems with, you know, maybe Western society, I think it's magnificent. And you should know that the essence of beauty in the world is Hakarat HaTov, is being able to appreciate the goodness that comes from those around you. And the Constitution is an amazing system. You come to questions of constitutional law. And there's a whole debate now concerning this right to bear arms. What did they mean, these constitutional fathers? What did they mean? Can you own a gun? Can you not own a gun? Is it causing more crime? Is it not causing more crime? And part of this constitutional debate, again, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a constitutional law expert, but just from the layman's perspective, seems to be what they meant when they wrote the right to bear arms. Well, who says they were right? They're human beings. Maybe they made a mistake. Maybe we shouldn't have the right to bear arms. In other words, if you say that ethics stem somehow from a God, well then you can't argue with whether that God is right or wrong. You can try to interpret what you think God means. But by definition, if there's a God, then you can understand how something can be objectively right. Now, don't get me wrong. This does not suggest that belief makes sense. Because it could be that people sort of realized they had this problem. So they said, let's make up God. Because then we'll solve this problem. Of course, then they have other problems. Which is, if there is a God, then how do you understand human suffering in the world? That's a problem the atheist doesn't have. So I'm not, for the moment, I'm just focusing on atheism. Anytime you are going to reach a situation where ethics are defined by human beings, the definition is then that those ethics are subjective. Whether they're mass subjective, or whether they're macro subjective or micro subjective, you know, I'll give you one more extreme example, which is such a ridiculous, absurd example, but it's an example which illustrates the absurdity of the issue. If you ever go to New York City, one of the biggest problems you will have in New York City is a food budget, right? I don't know, some of you here live in New York City. So the prices in New York City for food are ridiculous. And we used to drive across the bridge to New Jersey and do our shopping sometimes, just because, you know, you could buy a can of Coke in New Jersey for 15 cents, and you pay $1 in New York, right? So it's worth the price of a car for a year if you buy your food in New Jersey. Okay. So there was one guy who came up with a solution to his problem for a food budget. His name was Jeffrey Dahmer. Now, we think that that's mad. We think he's ridiculous. And our definition of mad is that he is just out of the norm of society, which means we're defining normal as what everybody decides. But for him, he thought he was right. And who am I to say he's wrong? Okay, I'm not getting now, I don't want to get too deep into what an atheistic society leads to, and I don't even want to get into whether America is an atheistic society or it's not. Is there separation of church and state? That's a whole discussion which is not for Israelite, we'll go to university, but understand my dilemma. So it seems to me that one of the biggest problems for the atheist is, how do I come up with an objective, call it an authoritarian ethic? Can I come up with an authority for my ethical system? That was the first problem. And as best as I could ascertain it, all of the different solutions that the atheists seem to offer very often dealt with how the ethical system works and not with what the source of that ethic is. In other words, that you can come up with an atheistic ethic that somehow works, that might be. And I want to tell you the root of it all. On the one hand, I think it's very important in life to believe in the basic goodness of human beings. To believe that the potential of the human being for good is tremendous. But at the same time, in order perhaps, and this is a discussion we're going to get to, for the human being to have basic good, perhaps the human being has to have the potential for evil. That's how I value the good. That could be. Am I willing to trust that human beings will always come up with a good solution? In our century, and you know the century has not even ended yet, more human beings have been killed by violence in this century than in the entire history of the world. I want to tell you something. In the 1800s, with the rise of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, this was going to be the dawn of a new era. The enlightenment of man. The Industrial Revolution. We were discovering as human beings how much we could do. World War I was going to be the war that ended all wars. What a joke! Chairman Mao says, if I have to create a China on the graves of 100 million Chinese, I'll do it. And he came very close to fulfilling his wish. And it's not just Nazi Germans. I mean, Stalin was one of the most psychopathic human beings in history. How do I define him as a psychopath? He ruled for 30 years. He got what he wanted. I'll give you maybe a less extreme example, which brought this to me to the fore. George Bush, at the end of the Gulf War, had a press conference. And you know, living here in the Gulf War was a very difficult thing. It's a very different kind of war. To be in a war where you're fighting and you have a machine gun and you feel you can do something, and especially you're young, you don't have family, you don't have children. But to be in a war where you're forced to sit in the room and watch your baby in a mamat, in a gas containment crib, screaming because she's terrified and there's nothing you can do, that's a very horrible kind of war. Took us a while to learn the trick of putting bamba and treats inside the thing. And the first night of the war, when they told us to get in, people really thought, God forbid, something, that was frightening. And the fact that there were armies charging into Iraq and you're watching the news, it was just overwhelming. And that Scuds were falling. The war ended. And this, you know, 100 hours of victory. And George Bush gave a press conference. How amazing, and the army and this. And at one point he said, and there were only 57 dead. Only 57 American soldiers lost their lives. In a war of millions of men. I thought to myself, you know, that's such a terrible thing to say. What do you mean, only 57 men? You know, Eric Sharon was the defense minister during the Lebanon War. If not the most, certainly one of the most difficult battles of the war was a battle for a place called the Bufor. The Bufor was a fortress in south central Lebanon, which was taken over by the PLO. And they somehow managed to get artillery guns up there. It was a crusader fortress built on top of the mountain. I was there, I saw it. It's unbelievable. They couldn't attack it by air because the walls were so thick that they just couldn't, it was impregnable. They couldn't get tanks up, it was like this. So the Golani Brigade had to take this thing by foot. They had to literally climb up the mountain under fire and take this mountain. They couldn't give them air support while they did it because it was too dangerous that the shells could fall on them. They gave them some smoke artillery and that was it. When they took it, and it was definitely one of the bravest acts in the war, and it was a tremendous thing. So you can imagine, like any other army, they made a big deal out of it. They had a press conference. So Eric Sharon, who was the defense minister, he landed in a helicopter on top of the Bufor. And praised, you know, the glory of the men and what they were willing to sacrifice, whatever, and that no one was killed. There was a huge scandal. Somebody had given him the wrong information. 6 Golani soldiers were killed in that battle, and he didn't know it. He almost lost his job. They wanted him to resign. There was a furor in the Knesset. In the end, when it became clear, he hadn't known, so he kept his job. You can put a value on one human life? If I have a subjective system of right and wrong, then ultimately my life is more important than your life. And even if I decide that your life is more important than mine, it's because that's my life system and I think that's more important. And that's a problem. Now, an atheist can be perfectly willing to say, fine, so right is right because I say it's right. And if tomorrow you beat me up and you say what you say is right, so then what you say is right, so what? As long as we have a right, who cares? And although that's very oversimplified, there are certain atheist philosophers who will say that that's the problem. For me, I felt, you know, I can't believe that this would be my existence. So that was the first problem for the atheist. You can't prove it wrong. But I found myself thinking, you know, if I'm looking for one of two possibilities, and I'm looking for the most logical perception of the existence of the universe, this doesn't do it for me. And there were two other problems that the atheist had. And I'll mention them briefly. We won't get a chance to discuss them now, but if I'm lighting up bells and you want to have a further discussion, I would love to. The second problem for me was, and again, this is my perception of atheist philosophy. I'm not an atheist. So you can't get a picture of atheist philosophy from me, because that's not fair. That'd be like me presenting you with a Palestinian perspective. So I'm just sharing with you my perspective because I want to get somewhere. And I want to tell you how I got to where we're going to be together. The second problem, it seemed to me, if the first problem was, what do we do here? The second problem was, well, how did we get here? And I'll give you just a very, this is incredibly oversimplified perspective, but I'm sure that everybody at some point, most people, when they're dealing with these issues, they come to this question. So it's important to be aware that this is some kind of a question. You know, imagine for the moment that you're walking, in New York City, on Broadway. Okay? So Broadway is a big avenue in New York City. You're walking down Broadway, so you find a silver dollar. You pick it up. Of course you pick it up. You're not an idiot. You can actually take it to a bank, and you can exchange it for a dollar. Okay? Then you see a second silver dollar. It's a foot away, right down Broadway from the first silver dollar. Do you pick it up? Yeah, you pick it up, right? Look around. Pick it up, right? Then you see a third silver dollar. Again, exactly a foot in a straight line from the first one. Now you're in New York City, so what do you do? What's this, a joke? You look for the string. Is there a candid camera? But you look around. You're sure nobody sees. You're sure. And by the way, halakhically speaking, I mean, this is not a simple issue, but if I find a piece of money in a public domain, so it's, you know, if there's a sign, if there's a name, whatever, but if not, if it's just a silver dollar, it may well be that I'm within my legal rights to pick it up. So, okay. So I pick it up. I see a fourth one and a fifth one. So what do I know? Somebody's putting this there for a reason, right? I mean, you run to the phone and you call up your mom, I don't know, whoever. You say, listen, mom, bring the truck because some idiot is leaving silver dollars every foot all the way down Broadway and nobody's picking them up. So you're going to be rich. Now, the truth is, you don't know that somebody left them there. I mean, for all you know, there's a Federal Express plane that was flying, delivering money to Tucson, Arizona, and it was flying overhead and the Bombay doors malfunctioned and all the silver dollars fell out and they happened to fall out in a perfect line down Broadway. People make a mistake. People think that you have to choose science or belief. That I can either live in the intellectual, modern, scientific world, or I can take this leap of faith. But to take the leap of faith, I gotta leave science behind and go into voodoo land. I'm not so sure that's true. And I can only share with you my perception. I don't think that science has to disagree with religion or with faith. I'll give you maybe a couple of examples. Take, for example, the question of, I don't know, the Bible. Does anybody here know what was created on the first day of creation? Anybody know?
Light.
Good. Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or, God says there's light. Does anybody know what was created on the fourth day of creation? Nope. What is the second day? Nope. Darkness is the first day. That's a big debate. Was darkness created, or is darkness the result, the realization that came with the creation of light? That's a mystical debate, but okay, yeah? Excellent. Moon, the sun, the stars, the luminaries. Let me ask you a question. How could you have light on the first day if the sun wasn't created until the fourth day? So, that's real easy, right? We do it all the time. Energy. If there was a Big Bang, and by the way, I'm not a scientist, but from my layman's perspective, the theory of a Big Bang makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, the frequency of the Big Bang was discovered, 1 degree Kelvin, Arnold Penzias, I mean, you know, makes a lot of sense to me. It seems to be the prevalent theory right now. If there was a Big Bang, and this massive energy somehow let loose and exploded, for all I know, if there's a God, maybe that's how God decided to create the world. Vayom Elohim Yehi Or, God said, let there be light. There was this Big Bang. Light is energy, photon particles. So maybe this Big Bang created light on the first day. Doesn't say anything. Doesn't matter to me. The verse says, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or, and God says, let there be light. The scientific community is fascinated by the Vayehi Or, let there be light. What do you mean, let there be light? How is that? What is that light? How did it come into being? How was the world created? Judaism is much more concerned with the Vayomer Elohim. If I see the creation of light, but I don't hear the echo of Vayomer Elohim and God said where it comes from, Judaism says, the Bible seems to say, I'm missing the boat. But those two things don't have to contradict each other. I'll give you another example. Take, for example, evolutionary theory. Now, I have my personal problems with evolutionary, certainly Darwinist. I don't know about neo-Darwinist theory. And the scientific community is starting to have problems missing links and whatever, but that's not the issue. First of all, a healthy human being, if there are that many brilliant individuals who believe in something, you should study it. You should want to know what it is that they say, and then you can decide whether it makes sense to you if you feel you have a perception on it. But I certainly don't think that evolution is a problem because it disagrees with the Bible. I mean, man was created on the sixth day. On the fifth day, we had the creation of animals. Before the creation of animals, we had the creation of lower plant life forms and crawling things, and before that, the water. And I know, by the way, that a day is not a day, because the sun isn't created till the fourth day. Our definition of a day is a 24-hour revolution of the sun, or the world, in relationship to the sun. If I don't have a sun, I don't have a day. So the fact that the Bible tells me there are 6 days, the Bible also takes the time to tell me, realize those days are not days as we know them. I don't know what they are. I know that there are 6 periods of time, but I have no idea what they are. It wouldn't matter to me that the Talmud says a day is like 1,000 years. 1,000 in the numbers of the Talmud just means a lot. It's a big period of time, and I don't know what it is. It doesn't matter to me. The Torah wasn't concerned with how much time there was. So, the Torah doesn't have to contradict science. Science is a magnificent tool for understanding the world of Torah, so don't misunderstand me. But one begins to question, when you look around you at the world, whether all of this could be random. I remember once I was having a discussion with somebody, I don't go out on the streets looking for atheists. You know, I don't. Are you an atheist? Good. Let's have a discussion. Right? He said, you know, I'll tell you what my problem with God is. He says, who created God? He says, I think you created God. But who created God? So I said, well, I can only tell you what I understand Judaism is saying, is that God always was. He says, what do you mean God always was? Well, what was before God? Well, there was no before God. God always was. That's eternity. He said, I can't deal with that. So I said, well, okay, I can accept that. I just don't understand how the world was created. Well, the world was created in the Big Bang. Well, where did that matter come from? Well, that matter always was, because energy is neither created or destroyed. But where did it come from? What was before that? Well, it always was, the eternity of matter. Ding! In other words, I've substituted the eternity of God for the eternity of matter. So it's not for me to say that one is right and one is wrong. Especially during this period of time leading up to the 9th of Av. It's written by a man called Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor. It's called Man's Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl survived the camps. He was a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. He developed a whole form of therapy called logotherapy based on his experiences. And he was fascinated. And some of the stories that he writes about from the Holocaust are just, they're just incredible. They're just, you can't read a book like that without having some time to think about what he says. And he describes an individual in the camp who determines that the Germans were trying to destroy the spiritual soul of Judaism. The Torah, that was this person's perception. And he decided that he was put in the camps to do his bit to prevent that from happening. There were many Jews in the camps who felt that they were fighting a war in the camps. And he decided he was going to study a page of Talmud every day and teach it to his nephew, his student. And this guy was a brilliant Talmud Chacham. He knew the Talmud by heart. And he was known in the circles of the camps. And he was always seen mumbling under his breath. And he went through the entire Talmud. And then one day he finished the entire Talmud. And the next day, it was quite clear he'd become a Muslim man. A Muslim man was a walking dead man. These people who were described as having vacant expressions in their eyes lost the will to live. He had no more purpose. One of the most difficult questions is, what drives us in this world? Viktor Frankl's suggestion is that we are looking for meaning. We're looking for purpose for our existence. If we are created randomly, then what ultimately is the purpose of our existence? Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think, God forbid, that every person who calls him or herself an atheist has no purpose in life, any more than I think that every atheist is an axe murderer. The problem of the atheist is not that an atheist is a serial killer. It's that an atheist wants to understand why they instinctively know that they shouldn't be one. So we try to find purpose in our lives. Ultimately, if we're here randomly, and if when we go, it makes no difference, then what's the point? So you say, well, you're here to have a good time. Well, who cares? So don't have a good time. Well, you're here to do good for others. So you don't do good for others. And they don't do good for others. And the world disappears. So what? And that's ultimately the question. Can I find purpose in my existence? And at the end of this whole series of discussions and questions and thoughts, I decided, you know what? I can't believe that if I've got two possibilities for the logical existence of the universe, which really in a way means the logical existence of me, that the most logical possibility is that there isn't a God. So now I want to start exploring, is there a God? And that's what I did. And I haven't stopped since. Now that I've told you all that, now I can tell you what doesn't make sense to me. And it's the reason why I felt it was worth having this discussion. Because when I was 18 years old, I was trying to find God from up here. And it took me a long time to understand that if you can only find God up here, you will always be missing one of the most important tools to find what Hashem is. And that's from here. I started to study Torah. And I started to study my Jewish identity. And I wasn't sure what I would find. And I decided at a certain point that I didn't know if there was a God, but that it made enough sense to me that I wanted to try to find God. And I didn't realize that what I was doing, that while I was looking, and that while I was hoping to get there, that I'd already arrived. Because I gradually found that there was so much beauty in what I had seen, so much beauty in what Judaism had to offer, that God found me. So having said that, even if I'm right, and even if the atheist has difficulty defining and determining what ethics are, I don't know that that's the perception that I should have of Hashem. that I have a God, so God gives me ethics. And it's true. My definition of ethics is that what God said is good is good. And what Hashem says is wrong, and fine. But that's not what it's about. Somehow, if I can find who and what Hashem is, if I can develop a relationship with Hashem, then that very relationship should define for me what ethics are. And I want to figure out how to do that. And it took me a long time to realize that what I had done was really to preclude almost my being able to find Hashem. That I had spent so much time focusing on this muscle, I had to almost unlearn many of the things I'd learned in order to get back to it. This is the most non-Israelite class you will ever hear at Israelite. Because it's exactly what I don't want to do. Now don't get me wrong. These discussions are very important. And yes, you know, I have a lot to say on them, and I'm willing to talk about them if anybody wants to talk about them, whatever. And I think they're important. But I think it's also very, very important. We want sometimes to put Hashem, to put God into a box. Does it make sense? Is it logical? I fell in love with history, studying archaeology and discovering so many things in the beauty of archaeology that made sense, that fit with Judaism and all sorts of other things. Until I realized, is that where I'm going to find God? In a fossil? And you can walk out here and you can see a remnant of a wall that's 2,800 years old. You can become all excited because it means that there was something here 2,800 years ago, and look at that, the Jewish people did exist. Or you can stand at that wall and you can try to hear the echoes of the people who were there. And you're really looking for two different things. And you have to understand that that's where I'm coming from when we have our discussions. Not that you should be. Having said all this, now we have an interesting question. And that's the third perspective. I told you yesterday there are two ways of looking at mitzvot. There's the mystical perspective, and there's the symbolical perspective. I want to tell you what the Rambam says, what Maimonides says. Maimonides says an unbelievable thing. He says the purpose of Judaism is to become a better human being, is somehow to make the world a better place. When monotheism sprung upon the world was in a terrible state of affairs. The Torah in Leviticus says an interesting thing. It says, Kedoshim tihiyu, you shall be holy. And that the purpose of being holy, the purpose of being is to become holy. Well, what is holiness? How do I define holiness? The Jewish definition of holiness seems to be coming closer to Hashem. So what does that mean? So the rabbis have a discussion. What does that mean? How do I become closer to Hashem? The Ramban. The same Ramban I mentioned to you yesterday out in that courtyard. And it's such an amazing thing to sit and learn an opinion of the Ramban from 600 years ago, sitting here right where he walked. But the Ramban says an unbelievable thing. He says, you know what it means, Kedoshim Tiyu? You know what it means to be holy? You know what it means to come close to God? You know what it means? The whole purpose of Jewish existence? Al tiye naval b'shut haTorah. That's what he says. Imagine for a moment you're sitting in a restaurant. Everybody's had this experience once in their life. You're sitting in a restaurant. And maybe, you know, you've decided, whenever you've decided, that you want to sort of, you know, develop a relationship with Judaism. Okay. Everybody in their own way. And you say, okay, how am I going to do this? Well, you know, Shabbat, that's difficult. Kashrut, that's difficult. Prayer, it's a lot of work. But you know what? Blessings. Maybe I'll play around with blessings and see if it makes me feel good, great. And if not, so dump it. So I play around with these things because that's easy. You take a piece of food, you made a blessing, you know, you think about it. And if it makes you better and you feel good about it, then wonderful, what do you have to lose? So you go into a restaurant and you're a little nervous, you know. You heard about this stuff, you wash your hands with the bread. Which blessing do you make first? What do you do? What are the blessings? And then just as you're having this dilemma, in walks this big, hefty guy with a long black coat and a black beard and a black hat. And you say to yourself, oh, wait a second, didn't Benny say he stared at me? Okay, but he's probably religious, so fine, right? So you forget that for a minute and you say, okay, I'm going to watch what he does. And this is great, I'll watch what he does and I'll see, maybe I'll get to know what they do, right? So you get this guy, he's the bearded rabbi of the day, right? And he sits down, right, and he orders a meal, right? And they bring him the meal and he's about to, just a second, and he gets up and he lumbers off and you watch him and you see he washes his hands and whatever. And you catch the blessing, you're all excited because you ordered bread too. So you wash your hands and make the blessing. And then you get back there and you see he takes it, takes a little salt, puts it on the bread, makes a blessing, catches the blessing, you're all excited, right? And this is great, you know, because you're watching a living role model. You don't have to read it from the book. And then you see that he's eating spaghetti. But He seems to have some dilemma. You see, he's looking around, then you realize he doesn't have a fork. They forgot to bring him a fork. Okay, that's not a Jewish thing, right? So what does he do? You just happen to notice. He takes the spaghetti in his hands, and he starts stuffing it into his mouth. He must be hungry. Now, I want you to know something. This disgusts you. And the spaghetti's coming out of his mouth, and the sauce is all over the place, and he belches. It's horrible. Did you ever see that movie, Monty Python, The Meaning of Life, right? Oh, so just one more mint, you know. Well, if you didn't see it, you don't know what I'm talking about. Right? You guy. And you're just appalled. And you can't even stay for the rest of the meals to see how he says the grace after meals. And you go home, and you say, okay, this is horrible. How can he do that? So you say, I'm going to look this up in the Jewish law books, whatever you have, a halakha book. And you're amazed. You can't find anywhere in the halakha that it says, don't eat like a pig. It says, don't eat pig.
Rambam.
Pardon? Hang on a second. We're in the Ramban. Wait a second. Hang on. And you, I didn't say where you found it. I said, you can't find it. Got to give me a break, right? Only have 10 minutes, right? So you can't find it. Even though I, at a certain point, said that my belief is based on the fact that right or wrong is what God tells me to do, comes along the Ramban and says, no, if you're sitting in a restaurant stuffing spaghetti, God is telling you that because your fellow human being doesn't want you to do it, that makes it unethical. So God came down and gave the atheist a hand. So I'll tell you what I think this means. The purpose, says the Ramban, the purpose of the whole deal is to make the world a better place. And my process of making the world a better place has to be that everybody sees that it's better. And therefore, says the Rambam, the purpose of Judaism, all of Judaism, is to make the world more ethical. To make the Jewish people more ethical, to make me more ethical. And therefore, if I want to develop a relationship with a mitzvah, which is what we were talking about yesterday, I have to decide, how does that mitzvah make me a better person? In other words, if I study kashrut, my goal in developing a relationship with kashrut, notwithstanding the fact that the reason that I keep kosher, whatever that means, is because I think that's what God tells me, fine. But my goal in developing a relationship with that mitzvah is, how does doing that make me more ethical? And if I can't find a way that the symbols of kashrut make me a better human being, then according to Maimonides, I'm actually missing something in the observance of the mitzvah. That's a tremendous idea. And I want to give you one last piece of food for thought, which is our introduction to what we're going to begin this afternoon. If this is true, then according to Maimonides, this whole book is a book of ethics. Am I right? I mean, the whole system, what the Rambam is saying is essentially, is that there are certain parts of the Torah that are very easy. It's very easy to look at some of the Ten Commandments. Don't steal. Respect your parents. It's easy to see how if I do that, I become a better person. But there are many things, I don't see how they make me more ethical. How does offering a sacrifice make me a better person? That's horrible. How does not eating a piece of pig, it doesn't make sense. Says the Rambam, if the system is designed to make you a better person, then your challenge is to figure out how each part of the system has an ethical message. Now if that's true, the whole book of Torah, everything in Torah is about ethics. So here's my problem, and this is something we talked about last time. I should open up the Torah, and what should I find? A list of ethical rulings. I should start the Torah and it should say, Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, pursue justice. It should say, V'yahavta l'reicha kamocha, love thy neighbor as thyself. It should say, don't oppress the orphan. It doesn't say that. In fact, it doesn't say anything. It tells me the world is created. And then it says there's this guy Adam, and he's around there with Eve, and they have a problem, and they leave the Garden of Eden, and then they have sons. In fact, it's a whole series of unethical stories. You know? I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a case study in failed family relationships. First I have the first husband and wife. They're not communicating. She's not listening to God. He's not listening to God. It's terrible. Then they have two sons. I mean, they have two sons in the entire world. One of them kills the other. This is great. I'm excited now about Torah. Give me a break. And then I get finally, okay, so I say, well, they're not Jews. The first Jew. Who's the first Jew? So this is great. Abraham comes along. So what do I expect to find? Abraham's going to get up and say, I am the first Jew. Thou shalt be an ethical people. Do you know an amazing thing? Do you know, in the entire life of Abraham, never once does he tell anybody to do anything ethical? We have a system in the yeshiva world, it's called Musar, to give ethics. And there's such a thing as a Musar Shmuz, it's a class on ethics, where a rabbi will stand up and say, you know what, forget the Talmud for a minute. Are you guys listening to each other? I heard last night somebody went into the dorms, he was loud, he woke up his neighbors. How can we learn Torah together if you don't appreciate each other? So he gives a Musar Shmuz. And he basically exhorts the students to become more ethical.
Abraham never does that. In his entire, even on his deathbed. There's no ethical will. Isaac, you don't hear right. Hello? I open up the book. I want to read ethics. They don't tell me any ethics. So I'll tell you what it's about. There's a magnificent story. And with this we'll end. Our beginning. Abraham, he's sitting outside his tent. He's sitting outside his tent in the heat of the day. And you know, the Torah doesn't normally take the time to tell me about the weather. Like, it's a very strange line. It's the heat of the day. Yeah, it's very nice. You know, I mean, Abraham was taking Isaac up on the mountain and it was a real scorcher. I mean, it doesn't usually tell me the weather. So the rabbis say, and this is the only case in the entire Torah where the Torah actually describes to me the weather. So the Talmud says, you know what, if the Torah takes the time to tell you that it's hot, it's hot! I mean, trees were burning. Unbelievable. Greatest heat wave in the history of mankind. Realize, by the way, that these Talmudic allegories are meant to teach me a lesson. Doesn't matter whether they really happen. But he's sitting out, it's really hot. It's the third day after this little minor issue that Abraham had. He was commanded by God to be circumcised at age 99. So he's sitting out in front of the tent 3 days after he's been circumcised. He's got to be in some discomfort. Okay. And as a matter of fact, we say that the third day after an operation, and this is true, is the most difficult day. You should not visit somebody the third day after an operation unless you're very close with them. So this is the third day. And he sees three angels. Now, he doesn't know that they're angels. Shlosha Anashim, three people. Nitzavim Alav, they're walking towards him. So he should sit there and say, no. Vayar, and he sees them again. Vayar Tzlikratam, and he runs to them. It's a 99-year-old man in a heat wave, third day after a circumcision, and he runs to these angels. You know? So you got a picture of somebody in the tent saying, hey, get, you know, something wrong with the guy. So the Talmud says, well, you know why Abraham was sitting outside in the heat of the day? Because he had no guests. And he couldn't imagine not having guests for his meals. He was looking to see if there'd be travelers to have guests. Now, what kind of a psycho sits outside in a heat wave in the desert thinking somebody's going to be walking? So it must be, if I'm to accept this, that Abraham's need to do good was so great that it motivated him to sit outside in a heat wave. The Medrash says, why is it that the verse says, Vayar, he sees the three people, and then Vayar again, he sees them again, and then Vayar, it's like what time he runs to them. Doesn't really make a lot of sense. It should say Vayar, he sees them once. So the Medrash says, the first time Vayar, he sees, this is an unbelievable Medrash, he sees that they are Anashim Chashuvim, they're important people. Ushchina mamtenet aleihem, and the divine presence rests on them. In other words, they're incredible scholars, tzaddikim, whatever. He still doesn't run to them. Then it says, Vayar, he looks and sees more. He sees Shenagu Kavod Zelazeh. They treat each other with respect. And then he realizes that they're great, and he runs to them. Now that's an incredible thing. First of all, it tells me that what Avram thought was really important was not the Torah that they learned in their relationship with God, but their relationship with each other. Second of all, it tells me you can learn a lot of Torah. It doesn't mean you're going to learn how to treat your fellow human being. You have to want to learn it. Which is why this is so important. But that's not what interests me. Then after he runs, he brings them forth. He says, Ekchana patlechem, I'm going to take bread. I'm going to give you bread, right? The yukachna matmaim, let there be taken some water for you. So there's an unbelievable medrash. The medrash says, because Abraham ran in the heat of the desert, because he did that tremendous mitzvah to do kindness for another human being, what he thought was a human being, 400 years later, the Jews in the desert would be protected by clouds of glory. They'd be protected by the sun. And because Abraham actually himself, despite his medical condition and despite his age, and he was wealthy, he had servants, chose to bring bread himself for these guests, one day the Jews would receive manna from heaven. Now that's an unbelievable perception. It means what the Medrash is telling me is what I told you yesterday. We don't know the implication of the given act. That millions of people in the desert could receive bread because one person chose to give bread. That's an unbelievable perception. But then comes the third thing. However, Abraham, he says, Yukachna, let there be taken water for the guests. So the Medrash says, wait a second. Why didn't he get the water himself? Because he didn't get the water himself. The Jewish people in the desert would always have problems with water. And this is true. You look through the Bible, every problem the Jews have, it's always the water. The water's too bitter, the water's too sweet, the water isn't there. Hit the rock, speak to the rock, find the rock, eat the rock. It's terrible. Now that's an incredible message, except I got one problem with that. Because if you look at the continuation of that Medrash, of that rabbinic legend, the reason that Abraham doesn't get the water himself is because he's telling his son to get the water. He's telling Yishmael. He says, Yishmael, get some water for the guests. You should do a mitzvah. So that's not bad. That's good. That's wonderful. You're teaching your son to do a mitzvah of kindness. That's wonderful. So I once heard from Rabbi Riskin, a Dvar Torah in the name of Rav Moshe Feinstein, a tremendous idea. He says, you can't teach your children what to do by telling them what to do. You have to teach your children what to do by doing. My children will learn far more from what I do than from what I say. And that's exactly what I think the Torah is trying to tell us. The whole beginning of the Torah is just stories. As if to say, these people are not going to tell you what to do. They are so ethical that you will learn what to do from watching them. And so I want you to understand, we as a people, even if our goal is to make the world a better place, we will never teach the world how to behave by telling them how to behave. Perhaps we can be an example by being better. But I'll go you one further. I will never be able to tell my fellow human being to become a better person because I tell them to become a better person. The goal is that I should myself become so ethical and so good that people around me want to become that way. And if you're lucky, every now and then, sometimes in life, you find people who are so ethical, they're so good. Being around them makes you better. That's the goal. That's the goal of Torah. That's exactly the beginning of Torah. And it's much more important than all the other things that come along. If I can become so good that people around me want to emulate me, if my children can be good, not from what I say, but from what I do, that's the goal of Torah. So the goal of Torah isn't for me to tell everybody else how to behave. The goal of Torah is for me to find a way to become good myself. That would be enough. And our challenge now is going to be to study Torah. And while on the one hand we're going to try to come up with a system for studying Torah, so that you can walk away and, if you decide to, study it on your own, try to figure out what that ethical system of good that the Torah wants us to learn is.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.